Hey guys, it's Jeffrey Gurian here from Comedy Matters TV, and you are listening to Verbal Shenanigans with two wild guys. So check it out.
But our shenanigans are cheeky and fun.
Yeah, I mean, his shenanigans are cruel and tragic.
Which makes them not shenanigans at all, really.
Evil shenanigans.
I swear to God, I'll pistol whip the next guy that says shenanigans.
All right, everybody, how are ya? How you be? How is it going out there? I hope everybody is locked and loaded, buckled up, ready for another week of this this variety show we call Verbal Shenanigans. Mikey, how are you down there?
I'm doing fine, Scott. Now, if they sit in the back seat while listening to the podcast, do they still need to buckle up?
Oh, yeah, because, you know, safety first. Safety first when it comes to the Verbal Shenanigans podcast. We don't want anybody getting hurt.
I think it varies between states, if I recall.
Podcast law? There's different
Well, like regular car law. Well, I mean, podcast law sometimes interferes with car law. As you know, I'm a podcast lawyer, so.
Well, let's jump right into it. You actually just reminded me of something. So anyway, guys, if you're tuning in this week for the first time, we are. That's Mike. I'm Scott, and you're tuning into Verbal Shenanigans. We have 254 other episodes here for you to listen to. So if we don't entertain you today, I'm sure one of them will slightly entertain you. And go check us out. Go look at our back catalog, man. So you just brought up car law, and I guess I'll get into this real quick. So over the last couple of weeks, I've been telling you like some interesting things about the strange community I live in, or the how it's very much a like a very small town America. Like there's always little things going on. It's kind of like a cult. Okay.
Are you trying to promote the new Lake House reality show that you're producing right now?
Yeah.
The Nashville Network.
Yes, you got it. So the other day, someone had from the lake had asked me, a friend of ours said, "Hey, it's King and Queen weekend, coronation weekend. Will you have a pickup truck? Will you volunteer to drive it in the annual parade?" Okay. So there every year there's a king and queen, okay? That's been going on
of the
lake,
community.
Of the community. Yes. And each year there's a different theme. So like this year was a Western theme. Now apparently this has been going on since 1923. So they have a list of all the kings and queens since 1923, and they're usually seniors in high school, like going to college.
Okay, so this is for the local high school, is it?
No. This is just for the lake community. They have their own thing, Mr. So they have the king and queen of Indian Lake, and then they have, and then they have Mr. and Mrs. Indian Lake, who are usually like a couple that does service to the community.
See, I got a feeling somehow back in like 1922, there was some kind of shotgun war, like Hatfields and McCoys at the lake. Well, and it just led to, all right, we're going to take a vote. And next year, we'll find out who's king and queen.
Well,
yeah!
I feel like every week you've created some kind of new show or movie that's come. There was Dog Beach. The week before, there was something else. But, so we go to the coronation. We went last year, and we thought it was the weirdest thing we've ever seen. So we're like, let's go again. It costs $1. They have this, like, they bring up all the old kings and queens, and the kings are dressed in suits, and it's very interesting. So anyway, that happened. So the next day is the parade. I said, sure, why not? They're like, the swim team needs a truck. I said, yeah, why not? So we asked two of our friends to come with us, and they decorated my truck, and I had like seven kids in the parade, like in the bed of my truck. And you know, I've had kids in the bed of my truck before, but usually not living.
Yeah, so, fun story. And I mean, it was just a coincidence. I mean, luckily they could revive those six, so you can bring them to the parade.
So the parade goes all around all the roads of the lake, and you're beeping, and people are throwing water balloons and super soakers and hoses, and
this seems like a lot for a little small community.
I know.
I mean, did they have water balloons back in 1923, police, or were they just like throwing chickens at
police escorted? By the way, police escort. parade. Now, the funniest part was, so our friend sat in the back of my truck, like the cab of the truck, and the dad of one of the kids that we're very friendly with, he was with the kids in the bed of the truck, and I didn't know, but apparently everybody who's driving and in the car is drinking beers during the parade. So there they are pouring beers for my buddy, like out the back window to him, and they're having the kids hand him him a beer in the bed of the truck as we're driving through my community. So it actually turned out to be a blast. It was about an hour and a half.
So you're saying you had a police escorted DUI occur?
Police escorted DUI, I guess is accurate. So everybody else in the car was having beers. I did not partake. It seemed a little, I don't know. Seemed a little risky, but the other ones were having, and they're having a grand old time. But it was quite an interesting experience. This weekend was loaded with interesting experiences, which I'm going to get into in just a second here. So yeah, that's when you said car law, that's the first thing I remember, because every part of that has to be highly illegal. Kids in the beds of trucks, I know, is not. People can't ride in the beds of trucks. Beers in the car, throwing water balloons, all of the above.
I got a feeling this is going to be like a weekly bit of lake life where we just talk. So, Berlew, apparently since 1914, we all go streaking as part of the summer solstice.
I did find out.
I mean, we all drink mead. That's what they did back in the day. And then we sacrifice a 50-year-old to the honey gods.
Yeah, like if I was telling that story, like if one of us was telling it and people had to guess if that was Georgia or New Jersey, I feel like everybody would guess Georgia. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah. We could have won some money there. You should have really held it close to your chest until we could have got something here.
Well, I even found out that like the Mr. and Mrs. King and Queen thing, like during the war era, all the men were gone. So they just changed it to a beauty pageant for the women.
Mm.
So I found that interesting.
We can't possibly go a lake summer without a king and queen. We got to do something about this. Yeah, I know the Germans are killing us, but we got to keep the lake tradition alive.
So all in all, it was it actually really was fun. Definitely something I've never done, never drove in a parade before. But So I guess that's this week's edition of Lake Life, if you will.
Everybody's living the lake life.
Oh, baby, lake life. So I got to get into this. I got to unpack this. This is quite an interesting weekend. So I coach soccer, and a guy I do some of his camps in the summer messages me randomly because we were talking the other day that he still plays in adult league. He's still very fit, he plays soccer all the time still. And he's like, yeah, one time I played Brian Scalabrine. He showed up to one of our games. I'm like, really? Brian Scalabrine, the bench guy for the New Jersey Nets for a while? And he's like, yeah, it was really funny. He's like, yeah. I'm like, oh, that's random. So Wednesday night-ish, I get a message, and he says, I got something more random than Brian Scalabrine. I'm like, what? He's like, well, Saturday morning, apparently my soccer team is playing against Iron Maiden.
Iron Maiden, excellent.
So, yeah, that Iron Maiden, like the huge band from the 80s that has a cult following. I'm like, what are you talking about? He's like, well, apparently every time they go on tour, whenever they stop in different towns, they like to play soccer. Like Steve Harris, their bass player, who is also like he writes all their songs. Still plays, 63 years old, still plays, and like the rest of the team is a lot of like. Crew members and lighting guys and musicians, and they come. So I'm like, dude, I was like, first I begged, like, hey, do you need a bench player? Like, I just want to be, I'll go in for 3 minutes or not go in at all. I just want to kind of be there and see this. I had nothing going on Saturday morning. And I'm like, he's like, no, we're full, but you can come watch. I'm like, all right. So I'm like, all right, so I'm coming. So he's also like, so later in the week goes, he goes, hey, we also got offered free Iron Maiden tickets that night. Are you interested in them? I don't really want to go. I'm like, I'm kind of interested. And then as the week went on, the interest in Bill, I'm like, oh, man, I remember last time I got offered a free Iron Maiden ticket and I didn't take it. And I hear their live show is like this ridiculous thing. Okay.
Okay.
And we start texting back and forth. And I'm like, I think I want to go. He's like, you know what? I'm in too. And then like the next couple of days, we're just building this up. Like, holy shit. So Saturday morning comes and they're playing at Montclair State University. Really nice field. And I get a text around 9:30, like, dude, we totally forgot. Like, all the guys are asking me, like, we need beer. We need beer. We got Iron Maiden's not bringing any, and we need beer. I'm like, all right, I'll grab beer. I just don't know what's open at 9:30 in the morning here.
Scott, you live in the lake life. You know where it's open at 9:30.
Yeah, I know, but this is
knock on the neighbor's door. Hello, I drove the King around last week and all, but by choir rule, you have to provide me a six-pack.
The problem was I wasn't in the lake. I was towards Montclair already because the game was going to start at 10. And it's so funny because I'm like, where am I going to get beer? And I miss an exit, and I'm like, all right, I'll just take this one and backtrack. And as I get off the second exit, there's just a big liquor store that says open. I'm like, wow, it was destiny. So I pick up some beer, put it in a cooler, and sure enough, I show up. And I'm walking across the field with beer, and I look across, and there's the Iron Maiden soccer team.
Now, I have to ask before you continue.
Yeah.
Did you put any thought to what beer you were purchasing due to the fact you were meeting Iron Maiden?
100%. So my first thought was, because it's going to be for the guys too. So I went with a 15-pack of all-day IPA, because that's a pretty easy drinking IPA. Mm-hmm. A lot of people like IPA, so I went with that. And then I thought, like, what if Iron Maiden doesn't really like IPAs? Because it's much more of a United States thing, IPAs.
Before you continue, I just see this scene, like, you're driving and you're listening to Iron Maiden and you're like, no, they would not want to drink IPA.
Kind of
this
accurate.
This band would not approve of this. I have to go back to the 10 a.m. liquor store.
Really not far off from the truth, because I was blasting Iron Maiden down. Kind of familiar me. Because, I love... their classics, and you know, I'll sing Run to the Hills, and everybody likes an Iron Maiden song, but I'm not like a super fan, but I dig their stuff, you know. It's a certain it's an 80s thing, you know, they're like as 80s metal as you get. So the other thing I went with a 30 pack of Budweiser. I figured it's a standard American beer, you know, so I just went with Budweiser right down the middle. Okay. Bud Heavy, not Bud Light, Budweiser, the red can.
Okay, straight Bud. Okay, gotcha.
That was my thinking. So I get there, and I look across, and Iron Maiden. Now, this is not just a recreational game in the park. They have full uniforms, Iron Maiden kits, okay? Blue, they had long-sleeve jerseys. Actually, I don't know how they even survived. About 100 degrees that day. So Iron Maiden in the back is like, if you know them, they have that Eddie, the Beast, the monster, like it's kind of like their logo. He's like imprinted into the jersey. On the numbers, it says there's little Iron Maiden signs, like full kits, three referees, legit. Like we were going, and then I look across and I'm trying to figure out who, like, I'm like, I know Steve Harris. He's the guy with the long hair. He's really easy to pick out. The rest of them, I'm trying to figure out who's an Iron Maiden. So I start talking to the one guy before the game, and they're all happy because I brought beer. The one team, they're happy. Like, hey, you can sit over here. I'm like, all right, that's all I want to do. And I talk to the one guy, and he's like, yeah, we're just part of the crew members usually. You know, we got concerts. I'm a light guy. I'm like, so did the rest of the band play? He's like, not really. He's like, mostly it's Steve. And he's like, some of the other guys are just his friends that he just brings on tour with him to play soccer with him. I'm like, damn. That is the life, man. Berlo, I need you to get like ridiculously famous somehow and just bring me on tour so we could play like, I don't know, whatever you like to do. Basketball.
Pickleball it is, Scott.
Pickleball would be great. Pickleball, sweet.
We'll just tour the world playing pickleball and then whatever I'm famous for, I'll do at night.
That sounds sounds great to me. Yeah. So game goes on, and there I am just watching Iron Maiden play soccer. They got, like, their old roadie coach. He's like, sitting there with his shirt off and, like, a big giant hoop earring. He's like, they're like, but they're serious, man. First 10 minutes, Steve Harris is, like, pinging balls over the place, playing possession, like, getting up and down the field. 63 years old, mind you. And I'm talking to them. They're like, yeah, he never comes out. Like, he plays the whole game. So meanwhile, everyone's subbing like every 5-10 minutes because it's hot. Mm. They're old men, you know. Like the field is actually where the Red Bulls 2 play. So the B team to the Red Bulls. So it's a full
minor league team, if you will.
Right. So right away, at first I thought the Iron Maiden team was pretty good, but they started losing steam about 20 minutes in, and then the team that I know, they scored 1-0. They ended up winning the game 2-0. Of course, my buddy, 2 minutes into the game, runs runs full force into Steve Harris. They collide. Steve Harris is up. All I'm thinking is, like, can you imagine he falls, breaks some fingers or something like that, and can't play that night because of you? You know, like...
Tonight's concert is dedicated to the a-hole who knocked out our bassist. Tonight... Instead of Iron Maiden, will be the Iron Maiden cover band.
So, game ends. They're pretty much cooked by the end. Everybody's kind of hot. It's really hot. Have some beers. I'm like, I got it. You know, how often am I, one, am I ever going to meet someone from Iron Maiden? Two, where am I going to meet them on a soccer field? Like, I'm like, I got to get this picture. So me and him went over and called. He's like, yeah, sure, take a picture. He didn't seem like, he was actually like so focused on the game. He was still like talking about the soccer game with his like center back. And he was like kind of yelling at him. Like, look, you got to cover, blah, blah, blah. And I'm sitting there like, can I get a picture? You know? But I got my picture, and that was really cool. A bunch of my brother's friends that I'm in this fantasy football league in, like, I was sending them pictures. They're all, like, that was their era. Like, Iron Maiden was the late 80s, early 80s, and they love them. They see them every time they're around. They're like, get the hell out of here. Like, no freaking way. Like, I'm like, yeah. And people were, like, amazed by the soccer thing. And I'm like, I know. It's pretty freaking random.
Okay. Iron Maiden soccer team versus the old school C3I soccer team. What's the final score, Scotty?
Iron Maiden soccer team is going to whack you guys up a little bit. Considering you said you lost like 30-0 to like regular Joes, I would say there's a couple guys on the team. I say it's going to be a similar type of score. I think it's going to be in the 20s. They had a couple kids. Like, kids who were definitely athletes who play. So I don't think you have much of a chance against the Iron Maiden soccer team.
Well, we'll have to figure out an 80s band that plays soccer that the C3I soccer team could have beat.
Maybe you guys got a shot against, like, the Stones. They're, like, another 10 years older than Iron Maiden. So, I don't know, though.
Yeah,
Mick Jagger is a beast.
Yeah, but never going to die. So, I just imagine them just being, like, vicious on the field. Jagger's from the UK, right?
Yep.
Yeah, so I got a feeling soccer's in his blood, where it's just like the whistle blows and like just like his face turns into this like monster of and just destroys us. Like,
well,
one,
his face might already be kind of a monster because he's a weird looking dude. And two, yeah. I agree. I bet you Mick Jagger can still get on a field. That guy is in ridiculous shape. Apparently, he does like hours of yoga per day and like the workout plans. He's a beast. The beast.
And I just imagine Keith Richards sitting there with a cigarette and goal, yet somehow, like, it's like, oh, he ain't even trying. Then we kick a ball and he, like, leaps 10 feet to slap it away.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So that ends. I meet back up. We are pumped for the concert after that. I'm listening to Iron Maiden all day. And it turns out we have VIP lounge tickets or something like that, family and friends. And I'm like, this is going to be awesome. Now we get there. Apparently, we were late for the meet and greet, which would have been kind of cool to meet the whole band. But so the show starts, okay? And it was freaking awesome. It was everything that you would want from an Iron Maiden show. It was over the top 80s. There was explosions. There was things. Let me go through some of the things that go on. Now, if you've ever seen videos of Iron Maiden, Bruce Dickinson is a maniac, okay, the lead singer. He is, like, short guy. He's a fencer. He flies planes. He's, like, amazingly smart. Like, but he goes out there. He must have had 15 costume changes. He had robes on. He had one of those, like, weird eyes wide shut, like, mask on at one point. He had lanterns. He's running around the stage. And the concert opens. Boom! They come on. A giant plane comes down from the ceiling and it's just flying over them as they are playing, and it crashes into the back. Now, all of them from far away look like you were transported back to 1985. They're wearing the exact same tight pants and vest, and they're sprinting around the stage, just all over the place. The one guy is stretching his leg on top of speakers, like knocking it down. They are shredding like it's like, holy crap. Like, these guys haven't lost a step. So the plane goes away. At one point, the trooper comes out, and he's like 20 feet. He's probably like 15 feet tall. He comes out, and Bruce Dickinson is singing and sword fighting the trooper, which is like this monster guy. They're having a sword fight. It actually turned into like slapstick comedy at one point. Like, he's like running through his legs, like, ha, ha, ha. Then Bruce Dickinson runs to the top of the stage, grabs the American flag, and shoots the trooper, and it explodes. Explosion happens, and the trooper runs away because he got shot by the American flag. So that's where we're at in the first 20 minutes of the concert.
This is the most insane thing I've ever heard of in my life. Like, this is the kind of concert, it doesn't matter who the singers are. Like, if Hanson had a show like this, I would go to every Hanson concert in Georgia.
100%. This, we were saying, like, you did not have to be an Iron Maiden fan to enjoy yourself. Like, you would have enjoyed it, yeah, no matter what. And it was just everything you could think of. At one point, they play Signs of the Cross, and he's walking around with a cross, and all of a sudden it lights up, and he's shining it on the audience. The whole stage turns into a church at one point. This giant angel comes down. I mean, and then at the end, finally, this giant Eddie head comes up, and there's just explosions. My favorite part, one point I look at Bruce Dickinson, I'm like, why has he got a backpack on? Sure enough, it's fucking flamethrowers. He's got flamethrowers, and he's just going, like, shooting flames out of each hand, and then cooling them off, like, with his mouth, like, and he was just shooting flames.
Jesus. I mean, that's a concert when you see some guy with a backpack and you have to think about it. It's not just, well, maybe he's got like some snacks in there or something like that. Maybe,
dude,
he's got his Gatorade back there to keep him hydrated. It's like, no, he's just shooting flames at the entire audience while they're doing rock and roll.
Fireworks coming down from the top of the set. It was everything you would ever want plus more. I think you, like I said, I could have taken anybody and they would have had a blast. We were like fired up the whole way home. We're like, Fear of the Dog, you know, like everything. Fear of the Dog. And he just got this like
mad. It just makes me wonder, how did rock and roll die? Because when this is the kind of stuff that goes in a rock concert, how on earth did kids be like, no, I can't get into that,
dude. It was amazing, and I got the tickets for free. If they came around, and apparently this was like the best time to see it because it was called the Legacy of the Beast Tour, and they played no new stuff. So it was like a greatest hits basically like all the way through, and that's all I want to hear. I don't want to hear any new or like deep cuts. I'm not the biggest fan, but honestly, maybe top five concerts I've ever been to. Just unbelievably amazing. The only, as far as theatrics and things like, the only two bands I can compare it to were Tool and Muse. Muse has a ridiculous live show too, as far as like props and things like that. So, but I highly recommend Berlew, seeing if they're playing down in Atlanta or something like that, and see if you can get some $40-$50 seats or something like that. But dude, they sold that two nights at 63 years old in the Barclays Center. Like, it's just, it's crazy. And everybody there wearing Iron Maiden shirts. Like, it was 1989. Like, it was absolutely crazy. But, all right, Berlew, it's that time. It's the time where we finally get to stop talking to each other and we get to bring on someone who's done much more in their life and has accomplished much more. So we'll stick with, you know, even like the mustache guy has definitely accomplished more than us. So
I don't know, Scott. I got to hear this intro before I declare that gentleman has done more than me. Continue, please.
So we have a cool guest coming on. I actually worked with him, I think, twice, maybe three times max. He's been on some shows before, in like showcase-style shows. And very interesting, boisterous kind of guy, has really crazy hair. But he's been around the comedy business for 30, 40 years, maybe longer than that. Helped write jokes for Rodney Dangerfield. You might know his station Comedy Matters on YouTube. He's always interviewing like Bill Burr, and Trevor Noah, Colin Quinn. Like, he's like everyone in comedy basically knows this guy. I mean, I know him. I worked with him, but apparently, all the big, gigantic stars know this guy, John Mulaney, Nick Kroll. He's been writing he was actually a dentist at one point, but he's got a couple books out. So the one and only Jeffrey Gurian is going to join us on the show.
You know, it's a good thing about where he went to school. He went to Temple University.
Yep.
So by what occurred recently, he's now officially the favorite comedian of Temple now.
he's their best entertainer.
He was in second place for a while, then certain things happened, and then he took the one spot.
Mr. Huxtable. But anyway, guys, so here is our interview with the very funny Jeffrey Gurian. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hey, how's it going, man?
It's going, man. It is going. Jeff, you should hear Mike on the other line, too. Mike?
Evening, Jeff.
Hey, Mike, how are you?
Can't complain, can't complain.
Doesn't help anyway, right?
Yeah, last main event.
I just saw you in a picture with some friends of mine, Tommy Gooch and Johnny Watson.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I actually, me and you did it. You were on a show I did a long time with Johnny Watson in some random theater in the Poconos.
Yeah, I remember that being a very long trip. Drove out.
Yeah, it was a very long trip and a very dead audience, but, you know, that's just how it goes.
Yeah, it was one of those crazy times, but it's all fun anyway when you think back about it.
Yeah, so, I mean, yeah, we've worked a couple of times along the way. So, where are we calling you? Are you in New York right now?
Yeah, I'm in the city. Yeah, New York City.
So, Jeff, I mean, you've been, you know, you look at your career and you've kind of been around comedy for a long, long time now.
Yeah.
Now, I know you were, or still are, obviously, but a comedy writer and a comic. Where did you start as a joke writer? Did you start writing skits? Where did you get your start?
It's a crazy story, and I'll be happy to tell it to you. I didn't realize we started already. We're on?
Oh, yeah, we're on. It's recorded anyway, so.
There's no delays on Verbal Shenanigans. You get right to the point.
Oh, there's delays, all right, but just with us.
I didn't know if there was going to be an intro or what. Okay, so how do I get started? I was doing, first of all, I was writing since I was 12 years old. And then I started doing little crazy short films. How I really got started up at Saturday Night Live was I was making these little films on the street, and they were like false news broadcasts. Like several men were arrested for smearing cream cheese on the ankles of elderly women who wore their stockings rolled down like bagels. You ever see the old women with the stockings around?
Yeah.
It looked like bagels to me. So I went to my grandmother, who had a great sense of humor, and she didn't have a Jewish accent, but she put on a Jewish accent for me as a favor, and I was so sick that she let me put cream cheese on her ankles, and she told this story that she was new in this country, and she goes, you know, Jewish people have two kind of stockings, one for milk and one for meat. She goes, and this crazy man... He smeared cream cheese on my meat stockings, and I can't get it off. And I zoomed in on the stocking, you know, on her legs with the cream cheese there. And then I was doing films about the Masters of Disguise. And the Masters of Disguise were two master criminals who disguised themselves as inanimate objects to commit their crimes. So it started out with two men disguised as coats rob a hat store. They come in over the arms of two other men, And they say, just act natural, like wear your coats and nobody will get hurt. And so police do composite drawings of the perpetrators, and it's two coats, you know? And so I did many crimes like that, like two men disguised a pair of eyeglasses, rob a local optometrist. They come in on another man's face. And I interview the guy, and he's like, I don't know what's going on here. I'm on my way into this eye doctor. I have my glasses adjusted. Another pair of frames jumps onto my face and says, just act natural, like wear your glasses and nobody will get hurt. What's this city coming to? So I do all these things, and I realized that I had to bring them up to Saturday Night Live because the show was brand new at the time, and I had a feeling that I should be on that show. So I was driving a pimpmobile in those days. If you've ever seen what the pimps drove in the 70s, it was like a Mandarin Orange Eldorado that had been made for one of the Isley brothers.
Love it.
And I bought the car. He decided not to take it. And I got confirmation on that, by the way, in recent years. But I bought that car, and I put a Rolls-Royce grill on it because I had met this pimp from Maryland, and I was very impressed with his lifestyle. And so I wanted to drive. He had a gold Cadillac Eldorado with a Rolls-Royce grill, and it had a clear bubble over the driver's seat and a clear bubble over the passenger seat, kind of like the Pope has, you know? So,
nice.
So I wanted something like that, and my wife is like, we're Jewish and we live in Scarsdale. Why am I driving an orange Cadillac, you know? She didn't get it. So I took that car, and I pulled up to 30 Rock, where Saturday Night Live is being filmed, and which is, to this day, is being filmed at 30 Rock. But in those days, there was no terrorism. You could drive right up to the door. Now you can't get anywhere near the place. But in those days, you could pull right up in front. So I pull up in front in this car, and I had a CB radio in the shape of a telephone. There was no cell phones or car phones in those days, but they did make CB radios, and I got one in the shape of a phone. So it looked like I'm on the phone. So I pull up in front, and everybody notices when you pull up in this car. And I threw the doorman a few bucks, and I said, watch my car. Lorne Michaels is expecting me. I had a lot of balls in those days, you know. I could never do that now, but in those days, I was a kid, so I did what I had to do. So I got in the building. I brought this tape with me. I snuck past the security guard, got in the elevator, and went up to, I think it was the 17th floor. And as I got out of the elevator, I'll never forget Alan's wife, Belle, who I'm sure you know, who is an award-winning producer, writer, and director. He was one of the head writers on the show at the time. He was playing handball on the wall with a guy named Neil Levy, who was a producer on Saturday Night Live, and he was Lorne Michaels' cousin. And I introduced myself, and I showed him the films, and he's like, wow, these are amazing. I never saw anything like this. And he sent me to his manager, which was so nice. He didn't just give me the name and number. He called on my behalf, and he said, you got to meet with this guy. He's very different, and he has these unusual films. So the guy he sent me to was a man named David Jonas, who passed away a few years ago at 100 years old. And he was managing Freddie Prinze at the time. And he was responsible for getting Freddie the show Chico and the Man, which was a very big sitcom at the time. And he was working with a bunch of comedians. And he kept trying to talk me out of being in the entertainment business. He goes, you don't need this. It's a crazy business. You're a dentist. You don't need this. He told me to go home and forget about it. But I persevered, you know. I wouldn't give up. And I kept coming to his office for like a year. And he let me start writing jokes for his comedians. And it took me about a year to learn how to write a joke. And through him, I got to meet Rodney Dangerfield, who was the first big star that I wrote for, and who started doing my jokes on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. Huh. But it was all because I drove up to Saturday Night Live in a pimpmobile and had the nerve to say that Lorne Michaels was expecting me.
I love it.
Wow. Yeah, well, you have sometimes you have to do outrageous things. By the way, what's the language like on your show?
Whatever you like to say.
Yeah.
Okay, no, I don't usually, I'm not anything outrageous, but I just want to know because sometimes something comes out and I don't want to fuck up your show.
Oh, no problem. Ooh. It's already all disaster, so don't worry about it.
Cool.
So this is your first experience. You had no, like even open mic or anything like that before this occurred?
No, I didn't perform for many years. I was too nervous because, you know, if you start doing comedy in your 20s and nobody knows you, you have the freedom to bomb, man, because when you first go up, you're probably not that good. So you have the freedom to bomb, and that's how you get better. But by the time I was ready to start performing, too many people knew me because I had written for a bunch of big stars. And I felt like it was a lot of pressure on me that I had to be amazing the first time I went up on stage. Huh. So it took me many years to get up the courage to start performing. Now I perform all the time, but
right,
it took me a very long time.
Now, what is that like early on? Are you just sitting at home writing jokes, as many jokes as you can in a notebook and presenting them? Or are you discussing with some of these comics what they're looking for? And then what is it also like finally getting that success and seeing someone else use one of your jokes? Is that a strange thing too?
Oh, yeah. It's an amazing feeling. I mean, you know, when I was a kid starting out, the Catskill Mountains were very big. The hotels, all the comedy shows. There was a lot of hotels. Now they're all closed. It's horrible. But there were hotels there and in the Poconos. But most of the big stars, you know, it's funny. Ron Bennington from Sirius XM Radio says that I'm the only guy he knows who knew the old greats of yesteryear and friends with the young guys from today. Because Milton Berle was my sponsor in the Friars Club, you know. And I got to write for Milton and Jerry Lewis and Henny Youngman, guys from the golden age of comedy. And, you know, and then I worked with Nick Kroll and John Mulaney. So
crazy.
there's a very big discrepancy between those two groups. But the first time I heard Rodney do my stuff, you know, you asked if I just sat home writing jokes. No, I wrote jokes specifically for certain people. So I would approach them in the Catskills. I would go to the shows, and when the show was over, I would introduce myself as a comedy writer. And if I thought I could write for the person, you know, you can't write for everybody. You have to get a feel for that person because you have to write in their voice. But I would introduce myself. One of the gifts that I have is that I can write in a person's voice. I can hear the way you present yourself, and I can write material that would be appropriate for you. So that's what I would do. I would introduce myself, and I would ask for an opportunity to write jokes for them. And they were all, I don't know why, but they were all very open to it. And I got a lot of experience that way, you know, because these people were famous. They could ask anybody in the world to write. And in those days, comedians assumed that they worked with writers. These days, most young comics don't work with writers. They write themselves or they bounce stuff off their friends.
Yeah.
If they're really famous, they may work with writers because once you do a lot of TV, you know, you need a lot of material to fill in. So you can't produce it all by yourself. You know, like the talk shows, they have teams of like 15 to 20 writers sometimes.
Right. Exactly.
Always creating material. But I would work with people and I would ask them what they wanted to talk about. You know, one time Rodney let me tape his act. He never used to let people tape his stuff, but he did with me and he let me tape. And at the end of the session, when I turned on my tape recorder, it was blank and I was afraid to tell him. I'm not very technical. I always make a mistake. I'm very into self-sabotage. So I made a big mistake and I wound up with a blank tape and I was afraid to tell him because look, it happened to me recently. I was shooting interviews for my Comedy Matters TV channel at Madison Square Garden for the Garden of Laughs.
Jeez, that's a big show.
It was a good show. It was Jerry Seinfeld and Bill Burr,
Tracy
Morgan. you know, like every huge star was there. And I got there particularly early to make sure that everything would go smoothly. And my assistant moved my stuff from one bag to another and forgot to pack my microphone. I show up with a camera and no microphone to do interviews. And I had 20 minutes before the celebrities started coming out. I thought I was going to have a heart attack. I didn't know what to do. I ran home and I left him on the red carpet and I said, look, just shoot something. And because it was rush hour in Manhattan. You can only imagine how bad the traffic was. Mm-hmm. And I'm on the west side of Manhattan. I had to run home to the east side of Manhattan to get my microphone. And John Mulaney left me this amazing message, which is on it's on my Instagram channel. He's like, Jeffrey, how can you forget your microphone? You have one thing to remember. He's like, you know, he's like, you were all focused on the hair. That was a message to me. I'll see you soon. He couldn't believe it. So to me, that was actually even better than just getting my regular interview. Just the fact of getting a private message from John Mulaney.
That's awesome.
It was hilarious.
That's crazy.
So but it's very exciting to see somebody doing your jokes, especially when they do them on TV. The first time Rodney did my jokes with Johnny Carson. Oh, it was amazing. And he used one of my jokes as his opening line.
Nice.
Which was, you know, it's so rare because your opening line sets the tone for your whole act, you know. And when Rodney would go on, you know, he wasn't a conversationalist.
No.
So he would have jokes for his set, and then he would have jokes for panel, for sitting down with Johnny. And I remember the joke. It was a very simple joke, you know. I can't do Rodney's voice, but everyone tries, you know. So he's like, you know, he would have these set openings, like, I'm all right now, but last week was rough, you know.
Right.
That I said, you know, I'm all right now. Last week was rough. I bought one of those whirlpools for my bathtub. The first night I used it, I lost 3 of my best ships. And it's such a simple, clean right. joke, but he loved it. And he used that for his opening, and he paid me $250 for that one joke.
There you go.
Wow.
And I thought that was amazing, because in those days, people were paying, you had to pay them for a joke. You know, it was like, it was crazy. And you don't get residuals, you know?
Right.
But he was a great guy to work with. And yeah, so you asked how it felt. It's amazingly exciting to see somebody doing your material. Unbelievable.
Hmm. When you have the relationships with these comedians, is it a purely business thing when you start, where it's like a boardroom or something like that and just throwing out jokes, or is it like a tight-knit friendship? How does this progress in this world?
Well, you know, it's different for each person. But like with Milton Berle, we became friends. I used to meet him at the Friars Club. When he'd come to town, he would call me. And I couldn't believe it. I'd be pinching myself. Like, I'm on the phone with Mr. Television. I was out in L.A. in 98 when Frank Sinatra passed away. It was the same year that Phil Hartman, you know, met his demise. And I used to write for Phil. Phil was a very dear friend. And I called Milton on the phone, and he took the call. And he said to me, I want you to know that you're the only call that I'm taking today. All the news people are calling me for comments about Frank Sinatra, but I'm not talking to them, but I want to talk to you. So we had a real friendship, despite the difference in our age. He was so much older than me, but he, you know, he liked what I did, and we had a real bond. Now, with Jerry Lewis, I only worked with him alone in his hotel room when he was being roasted. I was the main writer for the Friars Roast for about 12 years. And so when Jerry was being roasted, he was staying at a hotel in the city, and they sent me over to his hotel to work with him. And it was just the two of us alone for 2 nights working on his material. And while I was with him, he got a phone call that they discovered the gene that causes the Duchenne form of muscular dystrophy. And he was so overcome with emotion, like tears were running down his face. He was weeping. And I was there to share that moment with him.
Wow.
So it was a very special time. Look, I was sitting with Jeffrey Ross in Montreal at Just for Laughs when he got the news. What are you doing? Construction there?
Yeah, Scott, what are you doing there?
I'm making noise? I didn't even know I made noise.
Like stuff, it sounded like crashing, but not from HBO. stuff was just crashing. I was sitting with Jeffrey Ross. We were having a meal together when a guy came over and told him that he won the award for his movie Patriot Act.
Wow.
So I've had a chance to share some very intimate and unusual moments with people, and it was, you know, really very interesting. So each relationship is different. Some of them is strictly, it's more business, but it's always friendly. When you're writing jokes with people, there's a back and forth. You know, you have to interact with them. Once you send them the material, then you go over it with them. You see what they like, what they don't like, so that, you know, that you can gear the material towards them using it. So it's not just, you know, like one time Rodney said, I used to write him pounds of jokes, they used to say. I would bring in pages of jokes. And I said something to him like, Rodney, look how many jokes I brought you. And he's like, yeah, Jeff, but they got to be funny, you know? And I was like, yeah. Okay, that makes sense. They got to be funny. That kind of limits them.
Well, let me ask you, when you start getting into that initial joke writing for people and you're, you know, making a buck here, a buck there, are you still, at the time, are you still doing dentistry?
Oh, yeah. I was doing both for many, many years. And my nurse had strict instructions to never interrupt me when I was with a patient, except if it was for show business. So she would come in and she would say, Dr. Rivers is on the phone for you. Dr. Lewis is calling. The only one no one believed was Dr. Dangerfield. No one ever believed there was a Dr. Dangerfield. But they used to call me at the office, you know, because they didn't know what I did during the day. I never told people. You know, sometimes they found out because a lot of the TV news shows did stories about me.
Right.
That's actually how Joan Rivers found out. I never told her because nobody hires you because you're a dentist. They hire you in spite of the fact. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's not exactly a prerequisite for comedy. You have to go to dental school.
It'd be pretty strange if it was. It would be a weird business.
Yeah, it would be very, very weird.
You want to make it on stage, kid, you got to know where the molars are at.
Exactly. Exactly. You got to torture yourself through dental school for 4 years.
So when did you get the courage to make the jump onto stage? I know you're writing, you do all sorts of interview shows and panels and everything, but when did you actually start saying, okay, I got to get in front of these jokes instead of behind them?
It was about 12, maybe 15 years ago. So many people were telling me that I should perform, and I wasn't performing regularly in those days. I remember, I think the first time I went up was a place called Surf Reality. Are you familiar with any of the New York clubs?
Yeah, not that one. Surf Reality.
One for me.
So it was on Avenue A, and it was run by this guy, Rob, and it was hosted by a guy named Faceboy. He called himself Faceboy because he had no hair. So his face just continued up his head. I thought it was the best name I ever heard. It was a very famous open mic. People with all different talents could come there. And I remember getting up the courage to go up. I went up a few times. It was a lottery. You'd have to pick a number out of a hat. And they would stay. Everyone would get a chance to perform, even if they had to stay till 4 a.m. It was that kind of a very supportive show.
Right.
Talking about the lottery, do you know the story about Ray Romano starting out his career under the name Jackie Roberts?
No.
It just made me think of it. I did the book on the comic strip that Chris Rock did the introduction for, and they recently did a second version of it. The original was called Make 'Em Laugh. The new one was called Laughing Legends. But when Ray started out, the only comedy club around was the Improv, you know, that, what's his name, opened, why am I blanking on his name? You know who started the Improv in 1963? Bud Friedman opened the Improv in 1963. There wasn't another comedy club until Rick Newman opened Catch a Rising Star at the end of 72, and then the comic strip came along in 1976, on June 1st of 1976. So Ray went to the Improv to try out, and they had a lottery system, and they didn't get everybody on stage. They only took like the first 6 to 10 people. So to double his chances, he brought a friend with him. But he couldn't find a guy, he brought a girl. So he said to her, look, you gotta pick an androgynous name because I can't go up under a girl's name if they pick your name. So she picked the name Jackie Roberts. So as luck would have it, they picked Jackie Roberts out of the hat. He goes up and performs. Silver Friedman's running the club and she passes him that night. And he gets passed as Jackie Roberts. So he can't tell him straight to Mono. Because he's afraid if he tells the truth, she won't let him perform because he lied. So for the first 2 months of his career, he was Jackie Roberts.
That's funny.
and then he said one night he bombed terribly. And he said he had never bombed before. He had beginner's luck before that. But this night he bombed so bad that he didn't go back on stage again for 2 years. And he went back to selling futons, which had been his business. He actually sold a futon to Larry David.
There's a scene right there.
Who was not happy with the futon. He made him take it back, which was not a surprise. After 2 years, he couldn't take it anymore, and he came back to the comic strip. And that's when he started out as Ray Romano, and that's where he met his manager, Rory Rosengarten, who's his manager to this day.
Wow.
So that's not a story about me, but it was a story about the lottery and how you get up on stage. So I finally started performing after that, and then I went to New York Comedy Club. I remember Mike Buschetti was in the audience and really encouraged me. He said to me, that was such a great set. And so after that, I started performing more regularly. Now I perform all the time.
Oh, okay. Yeah, my wife is really good friends with Mike Buschetti. I've hung out with him a couple of times. He's a really good guy.
He's a great guy. Yeah, he did a lot on the Artie Lang show. You know, he was there all the time.
Absolutely.
Yeah, he's just a really fun guy.
So when you started in 75 and you made these films for SNL.
It was 77, actually.
77. Yeah. So let's fast forward to 2003. It seems like you started making short comedy films like I Am Woody and all. What kind of drives you to do both sides? Because it seems like a lot of people just want to be like the production person or the writer. It seems like you have a love for both sides to bring the full project.
I love everything creative, and I don't think you should limit yourself if you have a lot of interests. So I do whatever comes my way, you know. Woody Allen was always my inspiration, and when I met him, it was a very special time, and he read my earliest material and told me that I was very visual and that I should think of making a film out of it. And I did. Years later, I made, out of the ideas that I showed him, I made a film called The Men Who Series about men who do very unusual things, like men who take a pitchfork to the movies, men who enjoy men who enjoy Latin dancing with tools. You know, I'm sure you've seen a lot of Latin dancing with tools, but I had a guy who did the tango with a wrench that was unbelievable. And Peter Dinklage from Game of Thrones was in one of those films. He was in a film called Men Who Dance Where They're Not Supposed To. I had my artist, you know, in New York, it's very hard to find a place to park. So there are signs all over, no parking Monday and Thursday, whatever. So I had my artist make up an exact replica of a parking sign, but it said no dancing. No dancing Tuesday and Thursday or any other time. And we put it up in a very busy area of Manhattan. And Peter Dinklage played a guy who couldn't stop dancing, even though it was a no dancing zone. and he gets arrested. He was dancing with a 500-pound guy. And the two of them get arrested by a cop for dancing in a no-dancing zone. And Peter tried to escape, but they caught him. And it was it's actually on my website if you ever want to see it.
Right.
If you want to see Peter, you know, he's the star of Game of Thrones. So it just shows that you never know what's going to happen with somebody.
No. I mean, you, so like you wrote the book on the comic strip.
Right.
So not only are you're obviously a performer, a writer, but you're also even just talking to you now, and we do know this, you're almost like a comedy historian too, especially as far as New York and whatnot. What was writing that book like? And also, I wanted to know, like, when did you start stepping into like the digital generation where you did all this stuff on YouTube, Comedy Matters, and then Terabang and all that? Was that hard? Because I know you said you're not a big tech guy. Like, was it hard to step into the digital age with all that?
Well, it's interesting. You know, I'm not 20, so I don't know as much as I would like to know, but I know a lot more than a lot of people in my generation.
Right.
I'm very well versed. I edit a lot of my own videos. You know, I use Final Cut Pro 10. I spent a year at the Apple Store because I don't like to be a prisoner to my interns, to my editors. You know,
I agree.
It's terrible having to wait for somebody to edit your stuff when you got something really fun. So I'm pretty tech savvy, but it doesn't come naturally to me. I have to learn. You know, there's still a lot about Instagram that I don't know. You know, there's so many things about just writing on your pictures. There's a million things with filters and all. So I have assistants that help me with that. But, yeah, I've done a lot of different things. I wrote 6 books. Writing that book on the comic strip was a very interesting project for me because I'm fascinated by history. I'm fascinated by people that are successful because it's so hard to become successful in comedy and to become a big star. And one day around 2004, I think, I was at the comic strip with Gilbert Gottfried, and we were coaching Ann Curry, who is a news anchor, on how to do stand-up comedy for some kind of thing that she was doing on the news. And I was looking at the walls on the club and seeing all the huge stars that came out of there. Eddie Murphy and Chris Rock and Jerry Seinfeld and Paul Reiser, and just on and on. And it's the only club that's still open from 1976. And I said to Richie, has anybody ever done a book on the club? And he said, well, a lot of people had offered to me, but I never felt right about it. So I said, well, maybe we should talk about it. So he came to my house, and in my house, well, he said, I have more pictures on my walls than he has in the club. I have pictures that go back like 30 years with just about everybody in comedy. It's really crazy. And I never collected pictures like the way people do autographs. That was not the intention. I never thought I would meet any of these people because I didn't know one person in show business when I started. I don't know anybody. So every time I met somebody special like that, you know, it was a very... Like, it was a real energy exchange. Like, if you meet somebody and you're in a big crowd and there's like 5 people or 10 people, there's a good chance that they don't really know that you're there. They're not going to remember your name, you know? But if you're alone with them, just one-on-one, unless they're insane, they have to know you're there.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And then it was that moment that I would take a picture. I would capture that moment in time, that energy. So I have amazing pictures with like every... They go back 30 years, probably, with everybody in comedy.
That's awesome. And
so when Richie saw this, he says, like, you have more pictures than I have in the club because I think you're the guy to do the book. So it took 4 years to do the book. It took 3 years to get all the interviews and then a year of editing because I had 500 pages and the publisher only wanted about 250. My first 3 interviews were done in Montreal at the Just for Laughs Festival. And it was George Wallace, Larry Miller, and Paul Provenza were the first 3 people I interviewed for the book. And then we had to get, you know, Jerry Seinfeld's in it, Ray Romano, Colin Quinn, Lisa Lampanelli, Susie Essman, all the big stars that came out of there. It took 3 years. Jim Gaffigan's in it. Because even when they want to do it, a lot of them have such difficult schedules that it takes a long time until you can get them to sit down with you. So it was a 3-year process to get all the interviews and then 1 year to edit the book. It was crazy. And out of that, I became kind of a historian of comedy. You're right. That's how people, you know, they ask about that all the time.
So tell us about the new book. I know you sent me the cover of it. I know it's doing well on Amazon. The book is called Happiness. Yeah. Tell us about that. That's got to be, it seems completely different than the comic strip book. So what's it about?
It's very different. And it hit bestseller status on Amazon. It's a book on happiness.
There you go.
It's called Healing Your Heart by Changing Your Mind. And it's about learning to change your thought. The reason it's called Healing Your Heart is because from the time we're kids, every time somebody says something to you to hurt your feelings, breaks a promise to you, makes fun of you, bullies you, breaks up with you, anything hurtful, you keep that inside of you, in your heart chakra, if you're familiar with that term. Those things stay inside of you, and they affect your self-esteem, and they affect your self-confidence, and they affect every decision that you make in your life, because every time you have to decide something, you think about what you should do. You use your thoughts. Who else's thoughts can you use but your own? But if your thoughts are faulty, then your decisions are not going to work out for you. And so in my own case, I was a very severe stutterer, and I stuttered so badly. I stuttered well into my 20s and beyond. And I stuttered so badly that I couldn't even say my name. I could never say Gurian. Jeffrey, most stutterers stutter when they try to say their names. And my feeling is because your name is your identity, and if you're not happy with who you are, you can't really tell people. So I developed a cure for stuttering. My parents took me for speech therapy, and no one was able to help me because, especially in those days, nobody, to this day, nobody knows the exact cause of stuttering. But I realized one day that I didn't stutter when I was alone. I only stuttered when I was trying to talk to somebody else, which told me that you can't have a disability based on your location. You know, if a man has a limp, he limps in every room of his house. He can't go into a room and close the door and walk perfectly.
Right.
But if I could speak perfectly when I'm alone, then theoretically it means there's nothing wrong with me, that I created this for some reason, that it's an emotional and psychological thing. So I was determined not to go through my whole life as a stutterer. And I worked on myself for many years.
Now, was your stuttering, did that factor into you not getting on stage at all, too?
I don't think so, no. Because, you know what? That's an interesting question. I wouldn't be surprised if it had something to do. I never thought of that, but I started performing way, way after I stopped stuttering.
Yeah, yeah.
But who knows? I mean, it's certainly possible that I didn't have the confidence. Because in order to stop stuttering, you have to have tremendous confidence. You have to build yourself up. You have to build up your self-esteem and self-confidence to the point where you know that you can speak just like everyone else does, that there's no reason to give yourself a disability. When I went to college, I made myself run for the president of the freshman class, and it was a very big school. Like 7 different high schools fed into this one college. And I told myself if I could win the election, I wouldn't have to stutter anymore because it would show me that people liked me. I guess I had a feeling that maybe people didn't like me. And you can't win an election if nobody likes you. So I used to have other kids take me around to introduce me to kids I didn't know because I couldn't say my name. And these other kids were my campaign managers. And they'd be like, Jeffrey Gurian's running for president, vote for this guy, whatever. Anyway, I won the election and I was the president of the freshman class. And I still stuttered, and it was a great lesson for me because it taught me that outside validation doesn't work. It doesn't matter how many people tell you that you're amazing and talented and fantastic. It matters what you think of yourself. So I worked on myself for years, And as you can see, I no longer stutter. And now I'm on radio and I do TV and I lecture and I speak every day. And I'm always listening to my voice. I'm very aware of my voice. And I'm very grateful that I don't stutter. And as an avocation, I work with stutterers to teach them how not to stutter. Now, in my book, it's not just about stuttering. This is a much bigger story. It's about overcoming obstacles in your life. Many of us hold ourselves back. We don't achieve the things that we want to achieve because we create disabilities for ourselves. We create obstacles. We self-sabotage. We don't let ourselves reach the heights that we think we deserve. And it's very frustrating. So my book is called Healing Your Heart, meaning letting go of all the heart wounds that we carry by changing your mind, by creating new thoughts. You know, I use affirmations. I explain it all in the book, but it's literally changing the way you think in order to approach life in a different way, because you can't change your past. The only thing you can change is your perspective of your past. So are you familiar with something called the Serenity Prayer?
Yes, that's very popular in AA, correct?
Well, they use it there too, but it says very simply, it's not a religious prayer. It's a spiritual prayer. It says, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. That's the most important line, the wisdom to know the difference. If I wasn't given the wisdom to know the difference, I'd still be stuttering today. So there are some things in life that we have to accept. Every single person has something about themselves that they would change if they could. But certain things you can't change. You have to accept them. But then there are other things that you can change. And it's important to realize that. And if you work really hard, you can change them. So that's what I did. I changed them. And that's what my book is about. It's about achieving happiness by learning to think differently and letting go of the pains from your past. A lot of people had very difficult childhoods that really formed them as an adult, but it doesn't mean you have to stay that way. There are ways to change it, and that's what I talk about in the book. So it seems to be resonating with people, and they like that dog on the cover. I have a.
I see what you did there. I see.
It's a dog in lotus position, which, do you know how hard it is to get a dog to sit in lotus position? It's almost impossible. On an orange pillow, floating on an orange pillow. It seems to resonate with people because the book's doing really well.
That's great.
And now it's an audio book because I got contacted by a company who read the book, and they said, we love this book. Would you like to do an audio version? And they brought me into their studios. I had to send them a tape of my voice, and they okayed it. They said, yeah, you sound great, and we'd like you to do your own book, which is very rare because a lot of times they hire people to read someone else's book.
Yeah.
But because it's such a personal book, I was very happy to be able to do it myself. So it's available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, and it's an ebook, a paperback, and now an audiobook as well.
That's awesome, Jeff. It's been really cool talking to you. I could pick your brain all day about specific people and how you got to where you did, but I don't want to take up all your time. So really good luck with the book and good luck with, you got a whole bunch of things going on online, I guess, if you go check out Jeff's website. But Jeff, where is the best place to either interact with you or see all the different things you do? Where's the best place for someone who might not know you to kind of get a taste of you?
Well, there are two places. My website has a lot. It's called comedymatterstv.com. And if you like seeing your comedians in a very personal way, my YouTube channel I just passed like 2 million views, and it's interviews with everybody from Jimmy Fallon, Chelsea Handler, Amy Schumer, Amy Poehler, even women not named Amy are on there.
really? You don't say.
And as a matter of fact, on Wednesday, I'm heading up to the Just for Laughs Festival.
Nice.
Which, you know, is the biggest comedy festival in the world.
Yep.
So I'll be covering the red carpet and doing interviews with Trevor Noah. And
somebody calling you?
My phone is ringing. Yeah, it's going to stop in a minute, and then I'll finish what I'm saying. I know you'll edit it.
No problem.
Unless it's a celebrity that leaves a message, we'll probably exactly. keep that in.
It was actually Faceboy. Look, call.
He wants to come back on stage. You know, Nick Kroll is getting an award for Big Mouth, and Amanda Seales is getting an award for the best young comedy performer of the year that Chris Redd from Saturday Night Live will be presenting her with. Kevin Hart is getting the Generation Award. It's a secret who's going to be presenting that, but I'll be on the red carpet interviewing them all.
Awesome.
So if people want to see what's up there already, you go to youtube.com/Gurian News Network, G-U-R-I-A-N, Gurian News Network. All the videos are up there, and you'll be able to see. I got some really fun stuff with Bill Burr recently and Tracy Morgan and, you know, even though I had no mic, I ran home and got it. They were telling me about it. And on Twitter and Instagram, I'm at Jeffrey Gurian. So if any of your listeners want to follow, that would be very cool. And they can send me an email to jeffrey@jeffreygurian.com. I'm open to that. So I thank you guys for having me on.
No problem, man.
I hope you'll check out the book.
Absolutely. So it's been fun not only just to talk to you, but performing with you a few times down the line and I guess along the way, I should say, and hopefully down the line. So good luck with everything you got going on, and hope to talk to you again in the future.
Thanks very much, guys. Have a great night.
All right, Berlo. Jeffrey Gurian. Quite a lot of experience with a lot of people that I want to talk to and meet and work with, but you know,
yeah, he seems like the guy and all that. I mean, he's been a longtime comedian and he's done a bunch of stuff, but it's just like just the amount of stories he must have with every single one of them comedians from the 80s and 90s. None of them were boring. None of them was like, yeah, Robin Williams used to just go home and read a good book at night.
Yeah, right. They all had something going on. So, so Berlo, last week I went on my, I told you how much I was enjoying my spiked seltzers. And I, you know, we talked a little bit after our last interview and it wasn't getting good positive reviews from you.
Yeah, Scott, we're three into the four variety pack.
Okay.
And we are going a solid 0-3.
Oh, right no.
Yeah. Yeah. So on Saturday, I decided to do exactly what you described. I mowed the lawn. It was
ooh.
A nice long day. It was pretty hot down here in Georgia. Surprisingly, it's been cooler down here than it's been up there.
Yeah.
But it was pretty warm. I was sweating kind of bit, and I chose the pear elderflower variety. Okay. I'm like, pear seems to be the most unique flavor. I enjoy pears. That's probably the one I'm going to go with. And right off the bat, I realized this is going to be an interesting long haul going through all four of them.
I got to say, in the variety pack, I would say pear probably my least favorite.
Yeah. It starts off with a little bit of a pear flavor, and then it just goes right into this aftertaste. And I don't know if it's the carbonation. I don't know if it's the elderflower that comes in, but it's just like this wicked bitterness that hits me. And it's just one of those I couldn't get through the can. So then a couple days later, I went with the Clementine...
Hibiscus.
Yes. And it was better than pear, but the same kind of aftertaste result. The aftertaste was vodka in my taste buds. I really thought it was like one of them mixed drinks in a can kind of deals when I tasted it.
Man.
It went 0-2 to... None of them were overly refreshing.
Oh,
I mean,
man.
I I get the lightness of it.
Very light and summery.
But nothing goes there. So now, unfortunately, we're down to the two where the flavors are something I'm not a huge fan of. So I decided, I figure I like cranberry more than grapefruit. So I said to myself, well, the way things are going, the best flavor has to be the worst flavor that I like. So I pulled out the grapefruit tonight.
Okay.
And it surpassed pear in atrocious.
Really? Grapefruit's my favorite one.
Yeah. It has a lot of grapefruit, so right off the bat, that's not a good sign for me.
Oh, man. See, I like a nice, dank grapefruit, like seltzer.
Nah. This ain't my... And then for some reason at the end, it's salty, which I can't figure out why.
Maybe it's playing
tricks with my taste buds, and I can't understand it.
It'd be funny if you just got some, tainted variety pack. Like you got some variety pack that's like been sitting in a warehouse for like 2 years.
Who in the hell going to buy this? Not just sending some Kroger in Douglasville. Some idiot going to pick it up.
We only sell beer and whiskey. That's it.
Welcome to Georgia.
Well, I'm sorry I led you down the path of disappointment here.
Yeah. I mean, we'll get an update the next time we're on about cranberry, but...
It's not looking good.
Yeah, I think you're going to take the golden sombrero and go 0-4, my friend. This will not be partaken in the Burloo household again anytime soon.
I'm sorry. Well, you know what? We can't like all the same things, you know? But you would like Iron Maiden. I would not let you down there.
Yeah. If I had to choose between... If I had to choose between the spiked seltzer grapefruit and the flame-throwing, airplane-riding, fencing, insane rock and roll concert, I think I'm going to go to column B. I got to be honest.
It was so awesome. Run to the hills. God, maybe I grew up in the wrong era. But
your volume's going down on me for some reason.
Your volume's going down on you, Adam. I don't know what to tell you.
There you go. You're back.
I'm back. But, Burlo, I think we're going to wrap this one. We went long with Jeff, and we had a long intro, so I think it's time to go. You might as well get on out of here. Guys, before we get on here, Burlo, anything to promote?
I'm going to promote. This thing kind of tugged at my heart. It's a story I've read on a healer dog page.
You have a heart? Since when do you have a heart? Since when do you go out and get a heart without telling me?
Well, it wasn't in my podcast contract. Again, I'm a podcast lawyer, as I said earlier in the show.
Right.
So
like Charlie Kelly with bird law?
Yeah. I mean, I didn't want to go through the 10 years of bird law, so I went through the 6 of podcast law. So, but I want to talk about this lady has a dog. The dog's name is Ollie. And I guess she kind of had like an old school upbringing where they figure it's good to give dogs bones and so forth. Uh-huh. And sadly, Ollie got really sick. He basically it got stuck in his digestive system and it got him really sick. And he had to have some operations. And I'm going to show you this picture. As you can see, poor Ollie's got a little tube up his nose and he's recovering from the operation, and they're going through a lot of vet bills. The lady lives in Georgia, and it just tugged on my heartstrings, and I think it's something I shared it out on my page. I'm going to probably share it on the Verbal Shenanigans page. If you can help out, her name is Kelsey Cummings, and the GoFundMe is gofundme.com/help-us-help-Ollie.
All right.
He's a really cute dog. For what I understand, he's doing better, but he's still staying at the vets and keeping an eye on him. There's still chances of like a plasma transfusion and items like that. But it looks like a sweet dog that needs help, and they're trying to raise some extra money. So again, go to GoFundMe.com and look up "Help Us Help Ollie.
I am in the same vein here. I'm also going to promote a GoFundMe here. A comedy friend, a Jersey comic, New York comic by the name of John Minus. He a really good guy, funny guy. He is. He was recently diagnosed with bone plasmacytoma in his C4 vertebrae. It's basically a tumor in his bone. Okay. It causes him a lot of chronic pain. It's a rare disorder. And obviously what comes with that is lots of medical bills. And he's a very good guy. He puts a lot of comics up on his show in Montclair. So he is, you know, I'm wishing him the best. And he's got a GoFundMe up. Just GoFundMe if you type in John Minus Cancer, M-I-N-U-S. That's the name. And so far they've raised, his goal is $10,000, and they're up to $6,520 raised. So
very nice.
We are cracking away and wishing John a speedy recovery. I know it's been really difficult for him, and I've seen a lot of his posts. So help him out. If you got $10 even, it helps out. So again, that is John Minus Cancer. So yeah. Guys, as far as we go, we usually our episodes are out every single Monday, and that really hasn't changed over the years. We barely miss an episode. There, we have a big back catalog of interesting guests, ranging from John Walsh to Victor Wooten to Mark Summers, and many other in between there. So please go check them out and go leave us a review on iTunes if you're digging what you're hearing here. That really helps us populate and helps us get to the people who want to listen to us. And that's it, guys. Life is funny. Laugh at it. Keep the wind at your back. And we'll see you next week. Adios.
Cheers.
Wish that I had